Good evening, everybody. Had a request to do a talk based on the Kalama Sutta, which is almost the kind of manifesto of modernist Buddhism, and has become extremely well known, well quoted. You find it in posters everywhere. Yeah, most Buddhist centers have a sort of the Kalama Sutra up on a poster and these kinds of things, and it's become the basis of, you know, almost whole schools of Buddhism, like the kind of the Stephen Batchelor School of Buddhism and other things. I mean, curiously enough, of course, like many of these things, when we're presented with them, we don't necessarily know the context all that much. Kalama Sutta actually is traditionally nothing, frankly. You know, it's almost unknown in Buddhism until maybe 50, 60 years ago. Sits there quietly and unassuming in the Pali Canon alongside several thousand other suttas, which are placed in beautiful cabinets on the shrine and bowed down and worshipped. Yeah? And all these words which say, don't take us for granted and don't always inquire and don't believe everything by faith, and then they're put on the shrine and you bow down and bow down. No one ever reads them to find out that they're actually saying something quite else. So, and it was only when the start of the kind of the modernist Buddhist era that Kalama Sutta was noticed, really, by a few of the, I guess, and I'm not 100% sure of the history, but I would guess it would be some of the Sri Lankan scholars and people like Walpola Rahula and that kind of era in the middle of the 20th century, and they kind of noticed that this had some very important, very contemporary, relevant messages. And so since that time it became very central in the way that Buddhism has been presented in the modern era, and with good reason. And of course the problem is that when a sutta becomes very popular for that reason, when it becomes associated with a strongly ideological basis, then the actual meaning and message of the sutta itself tends to become a little bit obscured. Yeah, it becomes more that it's used to promote some kind of message. So I might just briefly, I won't read out the whole sutta in extension, but just read briefly the sutta to start with, and then we can have a bit of a look at it in more detail. So the Buddha went to this place called Kalama, and the people of Kalama said to him, Lord, he said, some teachers come to our town and they only teach their own doctrines. And they abuse and revile and censure and rail at the doctrines of others. This is not a modern innovation, right? Some things don't change, right? And then somebody else comes into town and they teach their thing, and then they rubbish the guy who came beforehand. So we are puzzled and in doubt which of these reverends spoken truly and which speak falsely. Now, the first thing that the Buddha responds, and I really, this is actually for me is the part of the sutta that I love the most. The Buddha says, well, you may well be puzzled, you may well be in doubt, for your doubt has arisen precisely about what ought to be doubted. Yeah? You're doubting about a doubtful matter. Yeah? So I really love that. Even if just that was the sutta, I'd be perfectly happy. Yeah? Because that, Isn't it an amazing message, you know, to be given by a religious or spiritual teacher? Yeah, he's not saying to them, "You silly people, why don't you believe what I say?" Yeah, he's not saying these guys are right and these guys are wrong. He's saying, "Well, yes, you're quite correct. It is a doubtful matter, and it's quite valid to have those doubts." And so this actually, to me, is very empowering because, you know, we all have a lot of doubts. You know? And sometimes the Buddha said, it's okay to have doubts because the question actually is doubtful. And so that gives us like a sense of confidence and a sense of space that we can hold the doubts and we can say, it's all right to have these doubts. It's all right to not know. It's all right to be confused. Yeah, but we keep on inquiring, and then maybe if we keep on inquiring, we can find an answer to our doubts. So then the Buddha then would give on a very... a famous passage, one which is actually found in a number of suttas, not just this place. He says, come, Kalamas, do not be satisfied with hearsay, or with tradition, or with legendary lore, or with what has been come down in your scriptures, or with conjecture, or with logical inference, or with weighing evidence, or with a liking for a view after pondering over it, or with somebody else's ability, or with the thought, the monk is our teacher. Okay, so this is a list of criteria which the Buddha is giving, which people, some people use for judging and for assessing their the truth of their religious tenets. And you can see from that list that actually, again, things have not actually changed all that much, right? We can hear that and we know exactly that's actually what most people, the kinds of reasons that most people believe in their religion. They believe it because, well, it's been passed down by that. It's because it's the tradition. I believe it because I have faith in it. I believe it because it suits me, yeah, my preference. I believe it because it's something contained in a scripture and it says that, yeah, that's what we're doing all the time, yeah. We've got, this is what it says in the Buddhist scriptures, this is what it says in the Quran, this is what it says in the Bible. But also important to notice that the Buddha puts on the same level, the same plane, logic, yeah, logical inference, weighing evidence. It's akara parivitaka in Pali is like the reflecting about different aspects of something, the liking with a view after pondering it is Pali is dhiti nijhana kanti. It doesn't really mean liking with, for a view, but it means accepting a view after pondering over it. Baba, somebody else's ability, the Pali is baba rupataya, which what it means is that it means that because you think that somebody else looks as if they know what they're doing or what they're saying, right? Yeah. So this is you know, the kind of bumper sticker that says "Don't follow me, I'm lost," right? So this is the whole kind of thing. You think, well, they obviously know what they're talking about. They've got a degree or they've got a robe, right? They look like they know what they're saying, so I should follow them. And the other one, samana no guru, because the thinking that the samana or the ascetic, the monk, is our teacher, is our guru. I'm going to believe it because my guru says this is what's true. Okay, so these are things that these are criteria that the Buddha said we should not rely on in this particular case. Okay, now I'll come back to that in a minute. But when you know in yourselves these ideas are unwholesome, akusala, they're blameworthy, they're condemned by the wise. Being adopted and put into practice, they lead to harm and suffering. Okay? Then you should abandon them. Right? So this is again the criteria which is being put back onto them, is that you have to know for yourself. The most important one is that when this thing is adopted, does it actually lead to harm? Does it lead to suffering? This is the most basic criteria. Yeah? You know for yourself, does this lead to harm? So, and then the Buddha goes on to analyze this. Okay, what about, and he does it in terms of the three unwholesome roots, greed, hatred, and delusion. And when all of these things arise, then as a result of that somebody does various unwholesome things and it leads to various kinds of harm and suffering. And so these are things which we can observe ourselves. We don't have to rely on tradition, we don't have to rely on what it says in the scriptures, we don't have to rely on even on logic or on faith or any of these things, but we can actually see for ourselves that when these greed, hatred, and delusion arise in us, that it leads to harmful effects. We can observe that in others. When these things arise, it leads to harm. And when we act not from greed, hatred, and delusion, but when we act instead of acting from greed, we act from generosity, from contentment, from giving and sharing. Yeah? Instead of acting from hatred, we act from love and compassion. Instead of acting from delusion, we act from wisdom. Then that leads to benefit for both ourselves and for others. And again, this is something we don't have to take for granted. It's something that we can observe for ourselves. Now, then the sutta goes on to another, in the next section. Now it says, when a noble disciple... Now the word, this is one of the slight ambiguities of this sutta. The word noble disciple usually means somebody who's at least on the first stage of enlightenment. Okay, so at least a stream enterer or one on the way to stream entry. And whether that's actually meant here is a bit uncertain, but I won't go too much into that detail. When a noble disciple is in this way free from greed, from ill will, greed, hatred, and delusion, then being fully aware and mindful, he abides with a heart imbued with loving kindness, extending to one quarter and to the second quarter, the third to the fourth, so above, below, around, to everywhere, and to all as to himself. He abides with a heart imbued with abundant, exalted, measureless loving kindness, without hostility and without ill will, encompassing the entire world. And similarly, with a heart filled with compassion, filled with gladness, and with a heart filled with equanimity, extending to the entire world. So this, of course, is the practice of the Brahma Viharas. And here this is talking about developing these meditations, you know, obviously to quite a high level, yeah? So this is one thing that's important to notice about this sutta, is that it has a whole context, right? It's not just one teaching. So often one part of this sutta gets extracted. So you say the Buddha said, don't believe in suttas, don't believe in scriptures, don't believe in faith, and so on and so forth. But so many other aspects of the sutta are not paid attention to. So one thing that the sutta is not about, it's not about saying, and this is what it's often used in a modernist Buddhist discourse. It's not saying don't rely on these kind of emotional qualities, yeah, of kind of faith and so on, but instead rely on the intellectual qualities of logic and reason. Right? That's how it's often presented, but that's clearly not what it's saying, yeah, because it puts both logic and faith on the same level. Yeah, sometimes it can be good, sometimes it can be bad, and rather, it's certainly not anti-emotional, because it's talking about developing these wonderful emotional qualities of the four Brahma Viharas. Yeah? This is very much a part of what it's saying. Yeah? And so then it goes on to another section, which has also become quite used for quite polemical purposes in some ways. With his heart thus free from hostility and ill will, undefiled and unified, a noble disciple here and now acquires these four comforts. Okay, so you get four comforts. One is a comfy sofa. I misread. He thinks, yeah. Well, at least someone thinks I'm funny. First one, he thinks, if there is another world, and if there is a fruit and ripening of action of karma that is well done and ill done, then I might be reborn in a heavenly world. This is the first comfort, right? So the first one is you reflect and you think, well, look, if this isn't all that there is, if there's another life after death, then I've done good karma in this life, my mind's wholesome and so on, so I'm probably going to go somewhere good, yeah? So make you feel comfortable. Second one, if there is no other world, right? There's nothing after this life, that's it. You live and then you die. Then, and there's no fruit and ripening of karma, which is well done and ill done, then here and now in this life, I shall be free from hostility, affliction, and anxiety, and I shall live happily. Yeah? So to do this kind of practice, to live this life and so on, it works whether there's anything after death or not. It still works the same, it doesn't matter. Then the third and fourth reflections are basically the same, except the negative sign. If somebody who's done ill will go to a bad place, then I won't go to a bad place. But if no evil befalls one who does evil, this is the fourth one, then I know myself to be pure in this life on both of these counts. This is the fourth comfort. So whether there's good as a result of good and bad karma or not, in either case, if there was a result after death, in either case, that you're going to be okay. Yeah? So it's one thing you can see about this sutta, and one of the reasons why it's become very popular is because obviously it's directed towards people who are confused, right? Who are doubting, who don't know what to think, don't know what to believe. And the Buddha is trying to say, well, listen, your spiritual practice, your ethical practice and life and so on, is not dependent on a set of beliefs about what happens after death. It's not dependent on a set of beliefs about this scripture or that scripture. It's not dependent on what's said in a particular tradition or whatever. But it's something which you can observe and apply in this very life. This is kind of the message of the sutta. The sutta is certainly not saying that it doesn't matter whether there's anything after death. It's certainly not saying that there is no, you know, heaven and hell or anything after death. It's certainly not saying these things. It's giving a conditional kind of argument, showing what applies in these different kinds of cases. So one of the great concerns of that sutta, and a concern which is reflected again and again and again throughout all of the Buddhist scriptures, actually, is a concern for what in philosophy what we call epistemology. Does anyone know what epistemology means? You know what epistemology means. What does epistemology mean?
Study of knowledge.
Study of knowledge, yeah. How do you know something? Yeah? Epistemology. Write it down. Okay. It's a word for today. All right? Word of the day. And epistemology, of course, is almost the Dhamma, really, because, you know, the Buddha is awakened. Right? The Buddha knows. That's what awakened means. It means the one who knows. And so that study of knowing and how do you know something is so fundamental to the Buddha's teachings. And so in many different discourses the Buddha talks about this from different angles. Now, of course, the best way of knowing something, the most certain way we have of knowing something, of course, is to just see it directly, okay? Not to hear anything through any other way. But, you know, if you want to know is it dark outside or light outside, you walk outside and you look at the sky. Yeah, you say, is the sun up or down? That's how you know. Yeah, if you're in a room, dark room where you can't see those things, somebody can tell you, but they may be right and they may be wrong. Right? So to see, always the Buddha said that to see for yourself is the best way of knowing things. But of course, it's not always easy to see for yourself, is it? Yeah? Certain kinds of things we can see and know for ourselves. Certain kinds of things we can't see. I'm going to get into Donald Rumsfeld territory here if I'm not careful. But and then there's the unknown unknowns. Yeah. So yes. But he had a point. I have to admit it, but he certainly had a point. Old Donald. Now, in the first part of this sutta, the Buddha gives a whole list of criteria which are uncertain ways of knowing things. Yeah, faith, preference, oral tradition, whether something was passed down in the scriptures, whether something can be worked out by logic, whether something it can be arrived at through reflection, and all of these kinds of criteria. Now, it's interesting. Here he just says, don't go by these things, right? So we can pick up this one particular isolated sutta and say, yes, the Buddha said don't rely on these things. So we can therefore throw out the scriptures, right? Because we don't have to rely on the authority of the scripture because we've got a scripture that tells us that we don't have to rely on the authority of the scripture, yeah? Yeah, and we don't have.
Is he saying don't rely on them or don't just rely on those?
Ah, yes, very good point. Yeah, exactly. And similarly with faith and so on. And again, from a modernist point of view, of modernist Buddhism, is that one of the things is that they want to try to say that Buddhism is not about faith, but it's about reason. Yeah, this is one of the ideologies of defining ideologies of modernist Buddhism. By modernist Buddhism, by the way, I mean just about every kind of Buddhism that you or I are likely to run into, unless we happen to be wandering around the backwoods of Bhutan or something like that. Okay, so modernist Buddhism is just about every form of Buddhism around these days. And so it wants to say that it's based on reason rather than on faith, and especially blind faith. Of course, I'm not trying to criticize these points of view. It's absolutely true. But I'm just trying to reflect about it and trying to say that this is one particular way of looking at the Dhamma, which is conditioned by a particular historical and cultural context. It's not just how the Dhamma is. Yeah? It's quite possible to pick up other suttas and look at it in other ways and come to a quite different perspective. Now, one of the things which is often not mentioned is that this list of dhammas, or very similar lists of dhammas, actually found frequently throughout the suttas, not just in this one place, in the Kalama Sutta. Okay, so often we're presented with it as if it's just this scripture which says this, and that's the end of the matter. Actually, it's like a standard teaching which the Buddha used in many different cases, and which he applied in different ways, in different contexts, to different people, to suit different occasions. Typically, as with this case, he would use these kinds of teachings when talking to people who are not Buddhists, but maybe interested in some way in Buddhism or in the teaching. For example, if he was talking to Brahmins or something like that. In fact, the mention of the idea of an oral tradition is almost assuming that the people you're talking to are Brahmins, because they were the only ones who had an oral tradition, as far as we know of, in the time of the Buddha. So, in some cases, what the Buddha would do would look at each of these things and basically point out that you can rely on these things, and it can turn out one way or the other. So you can rely on faith, and sometimes faith turns out to be correct, and sometimes your faith turns out to be not correct. Yeah. And similarly, you can rely on reason, logic, and sometimes it will work out right, and sometimes it will work out wrong. Yeah? So he's not trying to say that these things are kind of wrong or bad in themselves. He's just trying to say that they're not final and they're not complete. But there's another sutta where the Buddha taught, a very interesting one called the Chanki Sutta. And in the Chanki Sutta, the Buddha actually used a very similar list of dhammas, but instead of presenting them as saying don't rely on these things, he was presenting them as stages in our development and our growth of wisdom. Yeah, and so first of all there's like a faith, yeah, and so from a faith you go to visit a teacher, from visiting the teacher you listen to what they have to say, yeah, so you're hearing then the oral tradition, yeah, you then, having heard the oral tradition, you then reflect about it, yeah? So then you're relying on logic and reflection. Having relied on logic and reflection, you then accept the view, yeah? You have this quality, Dhyana Kanti is the reflective acceptance of a view. So it's many of the same dhammas, which is talked about in the Kalama Sutta, but instead of being something where the Buddha is saying, don't rely on these things, he's saying, actually, this is the course that it takes, leading towards knowledge. And he says in each way, at each stage of that, if you have faith, right? He puts it in terms of the preservation of truth. And again, this is an epistemological concern: how do you preserve truth when you're talking about things? If you have faith in something, you say, "I have faith in it," right? So if I believe that the Buddha was enlightened, right? I can say I have faith that the Buddha was enlightened, and that's preserving the truth. But if I say the Buddha was enlightened, yeah, I'm going beyond what I know to be true, yeah, unless I have the direct experience to know that for myself. So this is very interesting. It's a very conservative and cautious criteria which the Buddha is putting on truth claims. Yeah, it's a little bit like a kind of Wikipedia standard. Yeah. When you put things on Wikipedia, you're always supposed to reference it. You're not supposed to say this is true. What you're supposed to say is, well, this was said by so and so, and you give the reference. Yeah, and so it's being again very cautious in what kind of truth claims are being made. And so again, if you believe, if you say have worked something out by logic, then you can say, well, I've worked this out by logic, right? But you can't say that this therefore is true. And so the Buddha kept on insisting on this again and again and again, and taking this through right to a very, very profound level. And even when you experience something yourself, yeah, you still don't rush to conclusions, because different people can have different experience. Yeah, different people can see things in different ways at different times. And so it's until we have that kind of repeated experience of the truth, and until we know, ultimately, until you know that all of the greed, hatred and delusion is gone from your mind, yeah, that you know you're seeing the truth correctly. Yeah? Because even if we're seeing something, even something might be right in front of us, we're not actually seeing it if our mind is full of greed, hatred and delusion. I can say I have this direct experience of something, but my mind is actually already twisting that. And so it's not until that we've got rid of greed, hatred and delusion, that is, not until we're an arahant, that we can really say that we know what the truth is. Yeah? This is the Buddha standard for the preserving of truth. So this is a very kind of this caution in what we're saying, how to arrive at our understanding of the truth, and how what we say is true and what isn't true. So when we know that these kinds of teachings that we find in the Kalama Sutta are talked about in these different ways in different cases, then we can put it in a bit more context. Yeah, we can realize that the Buddha actually is not kind of denigrating faith. He's not denigrating an oral tradition or a scripture or reason or any of these kinds of things. Yeah, Buddha understood full well that these things actually all have their place. In fact, they are all essential parts of the path to the truth. It's simply that they're not actually the truth themselves. Yeah? So this comes back to the point that you made earlier, which is that what's meant in this sutta is that, you know, you just don't rely on these things just by themselves, or just automatically, or just on a reflex. But if you understand and reflect on them, then they can lead you to the truth. And so then the Buddha then goes through this leading through a process of testing. Yeah. So notice how scientific the Buddha's approach is. Yeah. He's actually giving a method for assessing the truth. He's not just telling you this is true and this is not true. He's giving every person a method and saying, you go away and test it. Yeah. This, of course, is one of the basic principles of scientific method, is that any finding has to be falsifiable and it has to be repeatable. Right. It's not just good enough for one person to say this is the truth. Other people have to go away and find out, test it the same way, and come to the same results. Yeah? So this is what the Buddha's doing. He's giving that method. You go away, see, is greed, hatred and delusion lead to harm, or does it lead to happiness? And if you find out, well, greed, hatred and delusion, I've got lots of greed, hatred and delusion, I'm pretty happy. What can you say? Oh, okay, fine, enjoy. But the reality is, of course, after you may have some happiness for a while, but sooner or later it'll kind of run out, probably. Maybe it won't, maybe we are all wrong. So, and then that other point that I made earlier about that teaching is that this kind of way of reflecting, this way of using analysis and insight, is not done in a kind of a dry fashion, or in a purely analytic or rationalist way. That is, it's got this whole emotional practice in there: practice of loving kindness, practice of compassion, practice of joy and gladness, the practice of equanimity. And all of these things are very integrative. Yeah, all of these things are integrative. They bring all the different aspects of the mind together. Yeah, they're unifying. Yeah, so that the understanding that you have from these things, the understanding that you have from your faith, from your reason, from your logic, from the oral tradition, from the scripture and so on, all of that becomes integrated and unified in your mind as a whole. This is also something which is very important to remember, because what tends to happen, certainly from a Western point of view, is that we tend to want to make these things oppose each other. We want to put faith on one side and reason on the other side, yeah? One corner. weighing 200 pounds is faith, and the other corner weighing 250 pounds is reason. And, ding, let's watch them fight themselves out. Yeah, that's how we think, don't we? Yeah, there's a kind of war between faith and reason, and it's killing us, frankly, isn't it? Yeah, this war between faith and reason is killing us. It may destroy the world, yeah? All of these kind of, religious extremism, essentially, religious extremism is the latest battle in this war between faith and reason, yeah? All of the people who are following the different religions, especially the Abrahamic religions, feel threatened because science has attacked their religion. Secularism has taken away so much of the grounds of their faith that they feel under threat and they feel they have to fight back, yeah? And this is why those wars and those tensions are felt very strongly in those Abrahamic and faith-based religions, and much less strongly in Buddhism and other Eastern religions, which are not based on that split between faith and reason in the same way. So this is not a small thing at all. So in the Kalama Sutta, these things are all integrated. It's all part of the same thing. Yeah? And then it finally comes to that last question of whether or not heaven and hell exist, whether or not there's such a thing as rebirth, then that still gives us a basis for our practice, a basis for our ethical life, and a basis for our meditative practice. This also is very, very important. One of the problems, and again this is a huge problem in the Western world, a problem which was really identified by Nietzsche, was that in the West, morality had been grounded upon a belief in God, right? Yeah. So when you take away a belief in God, nobody has everything is permitted. Yeah. This is what Nietzsche said. You know, if you don't believe in God, then everything is permitted. So this is a big problem, right? It's a big problem. So it's not a problem from a Buddhist point of view. So from a Buddhist point of view, it says it doesn't matter actually whether you believe in heaven and hell or you believe in an afterlife. From the point of view of your own ethical practice, it still makes sense to do what's good, to keep your precepts, to live, to develop compassion, to do all of these things, because you can see the benefits here and now. Yeah? Now, there are other contexts where it does make a difference. Okay, and so we maybe think about a broader context of like a higher sense of meaning in terms of our spiritual life. You know, what actually is the purpose of our spiritual life? Are we practicing to attain nibbana? Are we practicing to merely have a pleasant life, in a pleasant existence, and to be happy? Yeah, is that our practice? Do we want like a higher sense of ultimate meaning in our practice? Okay, so these are much deeper questions than the questions which the Kalama Sutra is actually addressing. The Kalama Sutra is addressing a much more prosaic question of what is the basis for our ethical conduct and for the basis of developing a healthy emotional life through the practice of the Brahma Viharas. And in that context, it doesn't really matter whether you believe in an afterlife or rebirth from a Buddhist point of view, because you can see those benefits, they're observable here and now. And again, this is something which is very empirical and which can be very easily tested, can't it? Yeah, you can very easily see that if people keep precepts, generally speaking, they tend to be happy. Yeah? When they don't keep precepts, they tend to get in a lot of conflict, a lot of strife, a lot of stress, and so on. And the same thing with developing the Brahma Viharas. When people have these qualities, loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity, that they tend to be happy people, tend to be contented people. And if on the other hand they have a lot of hatred, a lot of anxiety, guilt, and so on, then they tend to be not very happy people. Yeah? So this is these are things which are very empirically founded and which we can test. So I guess to sum up with the Kalama Sutta is that the Kalama Sutta, I think, has some very important messages and is a very significant text, and which definitely has its place in understanding and translating the Dhamma into a modern context. But sometimes I think it's been taken a little bit too far, and it's been taken to imply things that are not really what it was about in the first place. So anyway, I offer these few reflections on the Kalama Sutta for you. Okay, so let's finish my painting.
Anna.